This is Viewpoint with attorney and author Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is a one-hour talk show confronting the issues of America's heart and home. And now with today's edition of Viewpoint, here is Chuck Crismeyer.
Putin dreams of a third Rome, but one says it will become a second Mecca. What is it about Russia? What is it about Vladimir Putin? What is it about Ukraine? What is it about Kievan Rus? What is it about history? What is it we don't know? And if we did know, it might make a difference. And how might that affect, or how might the lack of the ability of the President of the United States to comprehend these things affect history? Does it make a difference? Does it make a difference at all? People are talking back and forth about the effect of the debate. Some say the debate wouldn't affect anything. Others say it affects everything. Some say the current putative president of the United States should be removed under the 25th Amendment. And some say, no, he's in good shape. Others say, no, his shape has actually been hidden intentionally from the American people, and we have been deceived. Does it matter? Some say what really matters is the ultimate effect on national security, on world affairs, that it's not just about what happens in this country, it's about what happens around the world. So what is the proper understanding, or is it both and or all of the above? Today on Viewpoint, we're going to take a particular focus concerning a country called Ukraine, and by reason of necessity, Russia. Because these two countries have massive effect upon the condition, the direction, the trajectory of our world. Donald Trump says that if he gets into office, within a very short period of time, almost instantly, he'll be able to resolve the conflict and everything will be hunky-dunky. Hunky-dory. Well, maybe it will, maybe it won't. But why does the presidency of the United States and the intelligence, the moral and mental and physical presence of the president of the United States have great significance in our world and in our national security? That's the ultimate question before us here today on Viewpoint as we dredge through some history there over in Russia and Ukraine. So I'm glad that you've joined us. It's conversation as always with ever-increasing conviction, talk that transforms. And today on Viewpoint, we're going to see that talk alone does not transform. You've got to be a doer of the word and not just a hearer, deceiving your own self. And we have been deceived for 4 or 5 years. There is a reason, apparently, why Mr. Biden was kept in his basement during the previous election cycle, because people didn't really want him to, the country to know his real condition and who he really was. If we can hide it from the American people and keep him from having to enter into debates, then we can pull a fast one over the people and present him as the loving teddy bear, Joe Biden, that everyone can embrace. Now it seems that much of that has been blown asunder through a debate. Why was he allowed to debate? Why was he encouraged to debate? Well, it depends on who you talk to. Some say that within the Democratic Party, he was encouraged to debate because actually they wanted to use that as a means for getting him out of office under the 25th Amendment and to bring somebody else in. On the other hand, the more they consider somebody else and all of the systems that are necessary to deal with in order to bring somebody else, whoever that somebody else might be, into the picture, is becoming not only confusing, but almost at the level of, well, impossibility. So we're going to have to live with what we have done. So what are the implications of that? As we know, there's been a lot going on there with Israel. Israel has been right front row center with regard to Mr. Biden. And actually, just in the last day or so, reports have come out to demonstrate that, in fact, Mr. Biden did cut off the flow of military equipment that had been authorized by Congress, and yet he refused to send it as authorized by Congress. In other words, he decided to exercise a supervisory control over that which Congress had already mandated be sent to Israel, contrary to what Mr. Biden represented in his debate. So all of these things become very pertinent. So it's not just a matter of Republicans or Democrats. It's a matter of some things that are far more nuanced, far more severe, far more destructive or beneficial, depending upon how you look at it, in our world and in our country. And so we look at all of these things here today on Viewpoint. Interestingly, in the midst of all of this comes this article. A U.S. governor has signed a call for 31 days of prayer and fasting. That's right. When there was a crisis facing our country, the founders did. Later presidents have done it, calling for prayer and fasting. So now Tennessee's governor has signed a proclamation calling for 31 days of prayer and fasting in the state starting on July 1st. That's today. The plan out of the State House as Joint Resolution 803 asks citizens to, quote, seek God's hand of mercy and healing on Tennessee, unquote. It cites the issues facing the state, from violence against its citizens, crime in schools, the evil of human trafficking, and the deadly threat of fentanyl. So should all Americans take the same action? Should the states of America all take the same action? Abraham Lincoln did call for the United States of America, all of the states, to adopt a time of day of prayer and fasting. The lawmakers note that seeking God through humbling and penitence is a way to resolve these issues. The petition was adopted by the state Senate 27-1 and the House 82-6. The lawmakers recognize God as the creator within the authority, with the authority to judge and bless. So what do you think of this resolution? So it says, be it further resolved, that we call upon all those who are physically able and spiritually inclined to do so to join in a 30-day season of prayer and intermittent fasting as we begin a new fiscal year as means of seeking God's blessing and humbling ourselves to receive His grace and mercy, transforming ourselves, our communities, our state, and our nation, said the lawmakers. How should we seek God's mercy and grace? Maybe we need to admit something in order to get His mercy. It's called confession. We'll be back.
Once upon a time, children could pray and read their Bibles in school. Divorces were practically unknown, as was child abuse. In our once great America, virginity and chastity were popular virtues and homosexuality was an abomination. So what happened in just one generation? Hi, I'm Chuck Chrismeyer, and I urge you to join me daily on Viewpoint, where we discuss the most challenging issues touching our hearts and homes. Could America's moral slide relate to the Fourth Commandment?
Listen to Viewpoint on this radio station or anytime at saveus.org.
Let's take a journey. Let's take a journey back across history, going back to the 6th century, in order to understand what's going on with Ukraine and with Russia. We need to go back to the 6th century, believe it or not. Now, some of us hardly would know what in the world that would mean to go back to the 6th century. But in fact, we have to, because if we're going to understand the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, we're going to have to do that, because there are differences of viewpoint that are so great and historically and culturally ingrained that in order to understand it, we have to go back to that time. So we were to go back to about 750 AD. There was a Scandinavian settlement that was founded like a trade center. And ultimately, in the 800s, the reign of a Varangian king, Rurik, was founder of the Rurikund dynasty of Kievan Rus. Kievan Rus. K-I-E-V-A-N Rus. So that's where Kiev comes, but that's also where Rus comes. Kievan Rus. And so today, live broadcasting for you. So today, we find Kiev, and we find Russia. But those names go all the way back to 860 AD. Then we move forward into the late 800s, into the early 900s AD, where the reign of Oleg of Novgorod, also known as Oleg the Prophet, was found in Kievan Rus. And Oleg the Prophet, in 882 AD, moved the capital of Kievan Rus from Novgorod to Kiev. So now Kiev in 882 becomes the capital of what is known as Kievan Rus. 882 AD. Now, if you listen to Vladimir Putin and you listen to his great address that he gave to on national television when he was interviewed a couple of months ago, that took the nation of the world by storm. It all began in recent history. And that's where the real issue came. Maybe around 2014. No, that's not where it began. It began back in the 800s. In 882 AD, Oleg the Prophet moved the capital of Kievan Rus from Novgorod to Kiev. So, from 912 to 945 AD was the reign of Igor of Kiev in what was known as Kievan Rus. He was assassinated. And then his wife reigned as regent for their son from 945 to 950 AD. Then we move to Kievan Rus in the late 900 ADs, 963 to 972, where it expands and enriches Kievan Rus through military campaigns. Then came another reign, a reign of Yarpolik, the first in Kievan Rus in 980 to 1015 AD. But the reign of Vladimir the Great in Kievan Rus converted the region to Eastern Orthodox Christianity. And that, my friends, is where things began big time. The reign of Vladimir the Great in Kievan Rus, in 987 AD, he converted the region to Eastern Orthodox Christianity. And he sent troops to help Basil II of Constantinople. We move from there until Kievan Rus is broken into several districts and policies in 1078 to 1337 AD, and then got hit front row center by the Mongol invasion, and Kievan Rus was conquered between 1237 and 1242 AD. Now, that's as far back as Vladimir Putin wants to go. Because going back further than that disrupts his narrative that Ukraine is Russian. Well, question, is Ukraine Russian or is Russia Ukrainian? Since Kyiv was the capital of Kievan Rus. You see, Christianity was actually introduced in Ukraine before it was introduced in Russia proper. And yet, how can we say it was Kievan Rus? So it was introduced in Kyiv and also in Russia, in Ukraine and also in Russia. You see the problem here. So when you go back, there's a twisting and a turning that has made it very difficult for Westerners to understand and even be willing to untangle the historical, shall we say, twists and turns that have created the situation that we now face, where Vladimir Putin believes that he is challenged, he is really virtually under a holy command to unify Kievan Rus as Russia and therefore take control of all Ukraine, to bring Ukraine back into formal Russia. The Ukrainian sovereignty movement formed in late 1980s and became an important political force after the 1990s when the USSR fell apart. But if you go back to 1917 with the Bolshevik Revolution, the Bolsheviks had to fight a very strong Ukrainian national movement during their civil war, the war. For the Russian Empire from 1917 to 1921. So out of that came a separate Ukraine, a Russian Ukraine or Ukrainian Russia that got its own government about 1934. So there has been separation between Russia and Ukraine since 1934 and an increasing separation in mind, in heart, in spirit, in culture, in thought, and anger from the Ukrainians against the Rus part of Kievan Rus. That's just the way it is. So how did the Russian annexation of Crimea and takeover of the Donbass in eastern Ukraine in 2014 change the sentiment toward Ukrainian identity? The more Russia pushes, the more it produces in Ukraine the exact outcome Russia leaders want to avoid. In other words, the Ukrainians resist the effort of Russia through Vladimir Putin to reunite the countries as one. They say, we're not that anymore. We haven't been that for a very, very long time. And that's why Ukrainians are still fighting. They see the war as an existential struggle because Putin ultimately wants to eliminate the Ukrainian state and nation. According to one writer, that's really what the war is all about. It's not about NATO. It's not about military bases. It's not about Russia controlling some piece of Ukraine. It's really about Ukrainians not having the right to exist as a distinct and separate nation and state. Oh, now that should have a familiar ring in the minds and hearts of astute listeners today. Why? Because it sounds suspiciously like the whole situation there with Israel and the Palestinians, to use the term Palestinian lightly. You see, the real issue there has absolutely nothing to do with making peace with Palestinians, which Mr. Biden and his administration and many others in the globalist world have sought to communicate as if that were the real issue. That's not the issue at all. It's the same thing happening with Russia and Ukraine. Mr. Putin, heading up Russia, says Ukraine doesn't deserve to exist. It really is all Russia. The Palestinians and their counterparts through Iran, Syria, and Turkey and so on, Muslim nations and Arab nations say that Israel doesn't deserve to exist and shouldn't exist. Therefore, support for Israel has waned dramatically since the original blast from Hamas in October 7th. And now things have turned dramatically on their head so that the Western world has coupled with the Eastern world against Israel, believing ultimately, although the Western world doesn't want to say so openly, but their actions reveal what they really think and believe, and that is that Israel doesn't have the right to exist. So, an article came out today from Israel saying, we're the most hated country in the world. Out of the 196 nations in the world, 195 don't like us very much. So we're just going to have to be who we are. We're going to have to stand for who we are and then let things fall where they may. Let God do his work as we resist their efforts, basically to amalgamate Israel into the Western world without a nation, without the nation of Israel, and allow the people or the nation of Israel, the land of Israel that God ordained and gave the deed or leasehold to the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob back in Genesis 15 and 18, let that land go 100% to the Palestinians who claim ownership of it. It's exactly the same scenario as we find going on now with Russia and Ukraine. History and the facts of history are coming home to roost. The chickens of history are coming home to roost. And they're leading to some very dramatic events. Now, if you have someone in the White House, which is supposed to be, shall we say, the head of the free world, that does not have consciousness of these issues, is unwilling to see them, and is more concerned about political power, perks, and position, and establishing a global government, then these nations and their interests become irrelevant, don't they? So you're pushing a completely different agenda. You're pushing a godless agenda, which is called globalism, to force all of the other issues into that mold. Which means, in order for that to happen, as James Paul Warburg said in front of the 1950, in front of the United States Senate, he said, we will have world government whether you want it or not. It will either come through consent or conquest. Well, the consent isn't coming too well in some corners, and that's why the conquest is coming about. We'll dig deeper when we come back, friends. This is Viewpoint.
There is so much more about Chuck Chrismeyer and Save America Ministries on our website, saveus.org. For example, under the marriage section, God has marriage on his mind. Chuck has some great resources to strengthen your marriage. First off, a fact sheet on the state of the marital union, a fact sheet on the state of ministry, marriage, and morals. SaveUS.org. Marriage, divorce, and remarriage. What does the Bible really teach about this? Find all of this at SaveUS.org. Also, a letter to pastors, the Hosea Project, SaveUS.org, and many more resources to strengthen your marriage. It's all on Chuck's website, SaveUS.org. Again, you can listen to Chuck's Viewpoint broadcast live and archived. Save America Ministries website at SaveUS.org.
Again, I welcome you back to Viewpoint. I'm Chuck Chrismeyer. We're talking about something that, in a sense, might seem a little convoluted, a little complex, because we're dealing with some nuances of history. But in order to understand what's going on with regard to Ukraine and Russia, and yes, even with Israel and Gaza and the so-called Palestinian issue, we have to look much deeper, much deeper. And the unfortunate thing is that our politicians, and yes, even our pastors and so on, are not willing to do that. We're somehow willing to deal superficially with things, and so we form knee-jerk reactions, thinking that, well, for instance, one knee-jerk reaction is that the deal with Ukraine is just an issue of democracy. It's just an issue of democracy. That Ukraine wants to be a democracy and Russia won't let it. Well, there are certain truths to that, but that's not the whole truth. That's not the whole truth. In fact, what we find is that the pursuit of pure democracy actually is somewhat demonic. We don't have a pure democracy in the United States, so why would we want anybody else to have a pure democracy? Our founders abhorred the idea of a pure democracy because they knew it was very dangerous. We're seeing how that danger can come about in Ukraine. What is one of the gravest problems that the Ukrainian people are dealing with now? Corruption. Corruption, friends. That's one of the serious problems of democracy. That has no counterbalancing controls such as we have in our government. That's why the Democrat Party despises the Democratic Republic. They don't like the Republic. They want a democracy, but they don't want a republic. They want to get rid of the checks and balances because corruption is somewhat a way of life within pure democracy. Why? Because the heart of man is desperately wicked. Who can know it? Our founders knew that. God knew that. Jesus knew that. The apostles knew that. But we don't want to believe that anymore. And so we see the problem coming about there in Ukraine. And our own putative president, Joseph Biden, went to Ukraine. It's a matter of record. He went to Ukraine and basically bribed, you could call it a bribe, he threatened the leader in Ukraine, you either get rid of this particular prosecutor that's coming after the company that my son is working for, and you either get rid of him within 6 hours or something like that, or you're not going to get the $1 billion that you might get from the United States of America. Now, you can put your own title on what that is, but that's what our president did. In his own words, and bragged about it. So he was complicit in the spirit of corruption with Ukraine. His own son. What do you think all the hullabaloo is about? Where was he getting the these millions of dollars from Ukraine on the boards of institutions there, corporations, when he had nothing to offer other than having the Biden name. The same with China. You see, we have been unwilling to connect the dots, friends. Who we put in public office is a serious matter. It's not just serious for issues at the home front, whether it be abortion or transgenderism or the economy and so on, as important as those issues are. It's also of great importance with regard to the security of the United States and the moral foundation and believability and respect that our country can have when its leaders act morally and truthfully. So when Joe Biden in his debate tells the country and his opponent that he has no morals, that he's a totally immoral person, what he's really doing is looking at himself in the mirror and using the very words he's describing his opponent with that apply to him. And that's why we have all of these issues going on with regard to the so-called Hunter laptop. Why did they try to hide that? Because they didn't want all of this corruption to come out that would compromise the ability for the Democrat Party to gain absolute democratic control so that there would never be the ability to resist it again. The very thing that they accuse Donald Trump of is exactly what their motivation is. I hate to put it so bluntly, but that's exactly what it is. Whether you want to call the kettle calling the pot black, but it's really projection. Projecting on somebody else to defer the heat from yourself. All right. So we're weaving a bunch of things here together on Viewpoint today. So from the Russian Times came this particular article. How a legendary Russian city ended up in Ukraine. Well, the title itself is deceptive. It's called the Mother of Russian Towns, that is, Kyiv. But they're saying how a legendary Russian city ended up in Ukraine. No, it might be more accurately said how a legendary Ukrainian city ended up being claimed by Russia. Once the heart of the ancient kingdom of Rus, Kyiv was made capital of Soviet Ukraine in 1934. Kyiv was made capital of Soviet Ukraine in 1934. But it was the capital of Ukraine, Kievan Rus, back in, what was it? The 800 ADs. This article says for a long period, Kyiv was considered more of a Russian city than a Ukrainian one. At least that was the case until June 1934. Well, that may have been true for a period of time that Mr. Putin wanted to convey as a great historian to the world in his interview a couple of months ago. The problem with that is that there were several hundred years. In fact, over 1,000 years between 1934 and when Kyiv actually was the first capital of Kievan Rus, which at that time was, for all practical purposes, Ukraine. So how did a place known as the Mother of Russian Cities, Kyiv, become a contentious symbol for two neighboring peoples. That's the issue in this particular article from the Russian Times. What we now recognize as Kyiv began as a settlement on the river's western bank in the 6th century. But things changed dramatically in the 9th century. True, medieval Rus was late to develop a written language, and literacy spread even later. Consequently, much of the history of the country and Kyiv specifically is pieced together. It's pieced together however you want to piece it together. In the 9th century, the 800s, a country emerged that would come to be known as Kievan Rus, the homeland of the ancestors of modern-day Russians, Belarusians, and Ukrainians. So, Kyiv became the residence of the Grand Prince, the supreme ruler of Rus. Not Moscow, not St. Petersburg. In 988, Rus converted to Christianity. The Kyiv metropolis, spiritual leadership was established, and the first stone church in Rus was constructed in the city. The first stone church in Kyiv was constructed in Kyiv. Although Kyiv formally retained its prestige as the former seat of Rus, new centers were rising across the land. Acknowledging Kyiv's supremacy became more a matter of tradition than necessity. And then, with the Crusaders sacking Constantinople in 1204 AD, and the Mongol invaders descending upon Kievan Rus in 1237 AD, things changed dramatically. And so it deepened the rift between different parts of what was once called unified Rus or Kievan Rus, and politically the territories destined to become Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine began to diverge into separate paths. So it wasn't necessarily all one thing the way Vladimir Putin wanted to see it. The emphasis was on Kyiv, not Rus and not Moscow. Kyiv never recovered from the Mongol devastation. And that's when things began to change dramatically. That's how Kyiv came to fall under Moscow's influence. And that's where Vladimir Putin wants to keep it today. So, what other issues are involved with regard to this Ukrainian conflict? It may surprise you. It may surprise you indeed. But we're going to talk about it when we get back. I'm not aware of anybody having talked about these issues. We'll be right back.
Have you ever considered what the early church was like? Many people are developing a heart longing for greater fulfillment in our practices as Christians. A recent study showed 53,000 people a week are leaving the back door of America's churches in frustration. What is going on? Why has there not been even a 1% gain among followers of Christ in the last 25 years? Could it be that God is seeking to restore first century Christianity for the 21st century? Jesus said, "I'll build my church." Is Christ by His Spirit stirring to prepare the church for the 21st century? The early church prayed together and broke bread from house to house. They were family, and it was said by all who observed, "Behold how they love one another." Incredible.
But the same can be found right now. Go to saveus.org and click Sell Church. We can revive first century Christianity for the 21st century.
It's about people, not programs. It's about a body, not a building.
That's saveus.org. Click Sell Church.
Welcome back to Viewpoint. Before we get back into the economic issues related to Ukraine, there is another aspect that overlays Vladimir Putin's situation there in Russia. Vladimir Putin dreams that Russia will be the third and is the third Rome. Now, where does that come from? Well, it comes from an ancient prophecy in the 1500s. I believe it was 1500s in Russia that said, Russia is the third Rome and there will never be another. So there was the Western Rome, that was the Vatican in Rome, and then that shifted over to Constantinople, the Eastern Rome, so to speak, that was considered the true Orthodox Church, because the Vatican was deemed to be unfaithful to the gospel. Then, when Constantinople was destroyed by the Muslims, the church in Constantinople shifted to Moscow. Moscow then became the head of the Orthodox Church. So the Russian Orthodox Church is deemed to be, within that prophecy that was made, the true Christian Church. Vladimir Putin has assumed that mantle as the political leader and has coordinated that vision, that viewpoint, with the leaders of the Russian Orthodox Church, and basically has merged both church and state together in a singular vision push that Russia would be the third Rome, the head of all Christian emphasis in the world, and there would never be another. That's the view. So when Julio Miotti, an Italian, writes for Israel National News with an article just a day or two ago saying Putin dreams of the third Rome, but it will be a second Mecca. Now, why does he say that? Well, because Russia is 20% Muslim. 20%. In 1991, the Soviet Union had 120 mosques. Within 20 years, they built 8,000 mosques. In the next 15 years, Russia would be one in which, in the largest metropolitan areas like Moscow, St. Petersburg, and several others, the majority of the population will be made up by the Muslim community. This is a problem that Vladimir Putin is having to deal with, because it's creating massive hypocrisy in his third Rome vision. Then enters Ukraine. Now what? First of all, is it true that the battle for Ukraine has anything to do with NATO? Answer, yes, it does. It's not an all or nothing thing. It has a lot to do with Ukraine, with NATO, because as Russia saw the United States pushing NATO ever closer to the border with Russia, with the installation of military equipment and so on, he said, we're not going to, I've been warning you since 2014, I'm not going to let this continue. So he justified his attack on Ukraine based upon the encroachment of NATO as a security interest threatening Russia. Was he right in that viewpoint? It's certainly a reasonable viewpoint. It would be very hard for any reasonable person to say he was out of order in thinking that. But the U.S. ignored the warnings. So did NATO. So, we go from there And we see also that as a result of the attack by Russia on NATO, or excuse me, on Ukraine, that it has actually facilitated the expansion of NATO and neighbors, nations that otherwise had no interest in becoming part of NATO have now become part of NATO. And the next one would be Ukraine. Will it become part of NATO? And why? Is it just about having military equipment and so on there on the edge of Russia to protect the Western world, Europe and America and so on, from Russian attack? Well, no. That's a major issue, but that's not the only issue. Here's the rest of the story. Ukraine's vast natural resources, including titanium, iron ore, lithium, and coal, are a significant factor in the conflict, and you never hear it talked about. Why? Because you just can't motivate people with such detail. They want to be told it's a matter of democracy. That'll get them stirred up. But to try to understand vast natural resources, titanium, iron ore, lithium, and coal, as significant factors in the conflict, well, it just doesn't motivate people much. But if we understand that, that broader understanding, that economic interests underpin geopolitical conflicts. So then it highlights statements coming, for instance, from U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham and a Washington Post article pointing to the critical mineral wealth of Ukraine and its importance to the West. The implication is that the war is not just about democracy and freedom, as publicly stated, but it's about securing these valuable resources. A more pragmatic and economically driven motive behind Western support for Ukraine. Well, that means potential deployment of U.S. military contractors to Ukraine and the involvement of North Korean military engineers on the Russian side, indicating a further escalation of the conflict. It warns of the dangers of escalating military actions and the risks of involved additional countries, which could lead to broader and more destructive warfare. It discusses Russia's updates to nuclear doctrine and why Russia would make severe threats concerning expanding nuclear power now. So with these considerations, can you understand more so why the debate and what you saw with your own eyes would be critical both to the United States and to the world? You can't have somebody that can hardly mumble out a sentence, cannot keep his mind on track, dealing with issues of this trigger-happy situation, of momentous issues such as this. Then there's the enormous financial cost to American taxpayers. The massive expenditure on the war might not be justifiable if the conflict is indeed driven by resource acquisition rather than higher ideals like democracy and freedom. What is it being driven by? We're not told. Is it about economic interests or ideological ones? How do you prevent loss of life and bring about peace when the reason why you're there is to secure all of these great, vast resources? So now there are tremendous geopolitical stakes that are involved. It's not just economics, it's geopolitical stakes. the involvement of major powers like U.S. and Russia and China and even now North Korea underscores the high geopolitical stakes. And then the nuclear risk that goes along with that. And then you have the lack of trust of the American people, and even in Europe, we thought this was all about freedom. We thought this was all about democracy. Maybe not. Maybe it's been a narrative, a public narrative, about democracy and freedom versus economic interests that weren't talked about. We didn't know about them. And then what else is it that we don't know about? Like not even knowing about the real condition of the putative president of the United States, Joseph Biden. Hidden from public view until not hidden from public view. And then all of a sudden, there's a shakeup. Yet the people in the Democrat Party that are talking about what a shock this is and so on, it's not a shock to them. They have been intentionally hiding these things from the American people, from the country, and from the world for 5 years. It's one of the reasons why they had to bring these massive legal attacks against Donald Trump to divert the attention, keep the attention away from the more important issues. I'm sorry to have to present things in a way that emphasizes a false trust that we the people have been called to make. Whether you're Democrat or Republican, none of us, whether we align with Democrat, Republican, or none of the above, wants to believe that our government is dishonest and is lying to us. That was the reason, friends, why in 1974, Republican leadership approached Richard Nixon, the President of the United States, and said, Mr. President, you must go. And he resigned. Why did they do that? Because he became known as Tricky Dick. Couldn't be trusted. Lying to the American people. A man who had had very close associations with the revered Billy Graham, who thought he was a great man. That is, thought Richard Nixon was a great man. But then when it began to come out, who he really was. You see, we need to have legitimate trust. Now, ultimately, friends, we must conclude with this. Ultimately, if you want to trust man, you will be betrayed. Man will betray you. God will not. It is better to trust the Lord than to put confidence in men. It is better to trust the Lord than to put confidence in princes and potentates and presidents, prime ministers, and yes, indeed, popes and pastors. Trust in the Lord, friend, with all your heart. Don't lean to your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He'll direct your path. Become a partner. Send your gifts, friends, by faith. Call us, 1-800-SAVE-USA. Write to us. We're preparing the way of the Lord for history's final hour. Also, discipling for destiny. May the truth be secured in your heart and in your life.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismier. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.